Everybody to the Northern Panel of the Nevada Supreme Court, Justice Michael Douglas, Justice Mark Gibson, Justice Michael Cherry. Our first case today is case number 66657, Energetic Lab and Blaster Inc. versus Simini. Ms., would you help me with your last name?
Of course, Your Honor. It's Teisling.
Teisling. Ms. Teisling and Mr. Jibb. Ms. Teisling, go ahead.
Thank
you. Did you want to save some time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to remind you when we get to that area.
Thank you very much.
A time area. Ms. Teisling, go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is Karen Teisling. I'm here today on behalf of Energetic Painting and Drywall and Energetic Latham Plaster, who are the appellants in this matter. This matter involves allegations of construction defects at a single-family residence in Reno, Nevada. My clients were subcontractors on the project who were hired by the developer, Silver Star, to do various portions of the project. There was a default and default judgment entered by the district court against our clients for failing to appear in the matter. However, the first and most significant issue in our mind is the fact that the district court erred in failing to set aside the defaults initially and then later the default judgment based on the fact that my clients weren't properly served pursuant to Nevada law. Under NRS 78-750 sub 2, the court is, or service is required to be made in two manners. It's required to be made first when a corporation is defaulted and no longer in existence by service on the resident agent as well as service on the last officers and directors listed at the Secretary of State on the website. In this case, it's clear that the only evidence of any service in this matter was on the resident agent who subsequently resigned from being the resident agent approximately a month after service was effected. Now, that service is fatal to the default, lack of service is fatal to the default and the default judgment because it simply doesn't comply with the requirements of Nevada law for service on a corporation that is no longer in existence in the state of Nevada. We believe that that evidence was sufficiently presented to the district court, and the district court deemed that even though the corporate officers had not been served and there was no proof that they had been served, that the service was still effective and went forward with entering a default judgment against my clients.
But the resident agent was still active at the time, had not resigned, even though the corporate formalities have not been applied, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The resident agent was still in place at the time of service. However, as the statute requires, there's an additional step. They were also required to send the personal send service to the last known corporate officers who were clearly listed on the Secretary of State's website.
Okay.
But we don't dispute that the resident agent was served. So without proper service of a default judgment and service of summons and complaint, the default judgment is void and must be set aside under Nevada law. With the fact that the default judgment was not set aside, we believe that the prove-up hearing should not have occurred, that the court erred in not setting it aside, and that that error was inconsistent with Nevada's underlying policy that all cases should be decided on the merits. As we all know, that's a fundamental requirement of due process, the opportunity to be heard, and the fact that the corporate entity itself did not receive service as required under the statute was fatal, and the case should have gone, the default should have been set aside, the prove-up hearing should not have occurred, and a trial of merits should have been held, or at least the parties should have had an opportunity to participate in discovery and the rest of the process in order to resolve the case.
Your client, participated in the prove-up hearing, didn't?
Yes, Your Honor. We did participate in the prove-up hearing upon notice that the defaults had been entered, and in all fairness to the court, and I don't want to misrepresent the record, our client's insurance adjuster did have some notice that there was a claim against them. Service was never proper as to the actual corporate entities, and we're not conceding that at all. But he was involved. When he became aware that a default had actually been entered against our client, he did take steps to hire counsel, have them come in, try to set aside the default judgment. And at that point, our counsel did appear, did make arguments to set aside the default, and those arguments were denied. The district court judge found the arguments with regard to the reasons to set aside the default at that time insufficient and went forward with the prove-up hearing. We also contend that there are some significant problems with the prove-up hearing itself. First being that the subcontract of ELP, which was one of the defendants, was an incomplete copy that was submitted to the court.
Were all the material terms of the contract submitted to the court?
Well, Your Honor, we contend that they were not. And this is why. If you put the contract, if you take a look at the contract, one of the key clauses that is significant in this matter is the indemnity clause. And the indemnity portion, while a portion of it is listed, does show on the contract itself, it's cut off. And more significantly than the fact that the actual terms, the terms are not completely listed there, is the fact that on every page of that subcontract, or nearly every page, that there's a requirement at the bottom, there's a line for this the contract to be approved by a corporate officer on each page, and you can't see that on the ELP contract that was submitted to the court and is accepted as evidence of the valid subcontract between the parties.
Was not information entered by the Samini's as to an indemnification provision in the document they had?
In the other document, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, it is in the other document. However, we don't believe that that's sufficient to make the contract of an entire separate entity imputed into them. And further, there was no additional evidence from anybody at, from my client or anybody else who could authenticate that my client actually did have full knowledge of those terms and assented to them. They're separate entities, and it's easy to lump them together because they're the same name, but the fact that there is one complete contract for one entity and an incomplete contract for the other, we don't believe, frankly, makes a difference with regard to the actual proof that was required to be shown for the ELP subcontract.
I guess part of the concern is whether, since your client, the clients did participate in the default hearing, did they provide any evidence that it was other than what is being argued, that there was an indemnification? In essence, did they put any information forward to say, this is not a fact?
Well, there was not, there wasn't. And when you say my clients participated, you know, it was a default prove-up hearing. So our scope was limited.
Prove up at, they can still participate as to correctness of the damages.
They can. And they did cross-examine the custodian of records from Silver Star with regard to this contract, who fully admitted that it was not a complete contract. This was the only contract they had. And without that, there was really nothing else that counsel could have done at that point, given the limited scope of their involvement in the prove-up process, to have additional evidence that the ELP contract was complete or that they had assented to the indemnity provisions.
But they were appearing on behalf of the two defendants. So it creates an assumption for some cooperation from those defendants with a defense.
I agree, Your Honor, that there was certainly a cooperative defense. They certainly had similar scopes of work. They were certainly involved in the process. They were certainly together in the fact that they had the same corporate officer who was not served, and they had counsel representing both of them. I completely agree with that. I still believe, though, that under Nevada law, which requires, in particular, signed contracts as evidence, the ELP contract is not sufficient.
In your time, because I know you're going to save some time for rebuttal,
yes.
Could you talk about the appropriateness, or from your standpoint, inappropriateness of the damages that were assessed against your clients?
Yes, Your Honor. So the damage, our issue with regard to the damages is that it's not so much a rehashing of the numbers that I want to do here today, because that would take us all day, probably. What I'm more concerned about with the issue of the damages is it goes back to an assignment that was agreed upon by the plaintiffs and Silver Star, and Silver Star and the subcontractors in a proceeding for a settlement that my clients were not parties to. That those provisions were never asserted or provided to my client's counsel in order to review if that was an adequate assignment, an appropriate assignment. So the very basis of the award of damages based on that assignment to the Simonies, because as you'll recall, Silver Star had stepped out at that point. They had assigned their rights to the Simonies to proceed. We believe that there were some problems with evidence presented, as well as the court's analysis or specification, the findings of fact and conclusions of law, with regard to how she made the allocation of damages. In addition, there were other settling subcontracts. As the court is well aware, these are complex construction defect cases where there are multiple settling defendants, subcontractors, third-party defendants, which had, in fact, settled. And there was just simply no way for our clients to assess whether or not those allocations were appropriately made, whether or not the appropriate setups were made, largely because of the fact that they were not given the opportunity to review the actual terms of the assignment, and that the court made a conclusory finding that there was such an assignment.
This was basically an indemnification award, in essence, with a percentage settlement, without speaking as to what particularly your clients have done wrong.
Correct, Your Honor. We believe that's the case. And there was evidence of a cost of repair, but as we all know, there's multiple trades involved in these issues. There's multiple trades on any given project. There was simply no breakdown or allocation that was specified as to any allocation to any other subcontractors than my clients. And that's our issue with the damages. So the only other issue I have for you today is with regard to the expert costs. We believe that they are inappropriate. There was no specification that there was a necessary, and that costs in excess of the statutory minimum of the 15, or the statutory maximum of the $1,500 for expert costs was warranted in this case by the findings of the court. There's a case law, Frazier versus Drake, which clearly states that any findings by the district court of a award of expert costs above that statutory cap need to be specified, and they simply weren't. So with that, I'd like to reserve my time.
You've got about 2.5 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jin.
Good morning, may I please report. My name is William Gann of the law firm of Leverty & Associates, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents in this case, Robert and Gail Cimini. The first issue that was raised by Energetic was whether the service process was proper. Quite frankly, to find in their favor, what you have to do is you have to override the express language of NRS 78750 and turn the word may in that statute into a shall.
What about the word and, though, where it talks about the A and B? It says the registered agent of the corporation, if there is one, and each officer and director.
Yes.
I can understand your argument on may, and I agree with you. It would have been much easier if it had been shall, as far as the statute is concerned, but the and bothers me.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. If it is being mailed under subsection 2, You must mail it to both the resident agent and the officer. Service was done personally by a process server just down the street here to American Corporate Register on February 1st of 2012.
So your position, as long as the resident agent was still listed and had not resigned and a resignation had not been filed with the Secretary of State, that's sufficient service?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And actually, in the most recent legislature, they amended NRS 14020 to make that very clear that that's the case. And the testimony at before the legislature says this is merely a clarification. This is not a change in the law. This is merely clarifying the law so that it's clear. So there must have been some issue somewhere by somebody not accepting service, but it was no change in the law. It was just to make the law much more clear.
What was the time frame between the service of process and the filing of the motion by Energetic?
It was over a year. What had happened was on February 1st, 2012, service of process upon the corporate agent. The default was taken on July 30th, which was approximately 2 weeks after the insurance company had said that they were going to decline coverage. Fast forward through April of the following year, there was a mandatory status conference in Department 1 at the Second Judicial. At right about that time, it's a little unclear exactly when, although it's something irrelevant, counsel was assigned to defend Energetic. Whether it's properly assigned or not and have the proper standing is actually one of the issues we have raised. April 16th, the first motion is to lift the default is filed. Much more than 6 months.
So excusable neglect would not apply at all? What you're saying, or could it still apply?
Excusable neglect may apply. The excusable neglect under 60B appears to be for a default judgment, and this is merely for the first step, the clerk's default. The default judgment is hearing does not happen until early June. Fast forward about a year, the actual written judgment is entered at that point.
I know that when I was practicing, I one time had to set aside a default, and a certain district judge who's now a Supreme Court colleague, for $500 I was able to set it, not to him personally, but to the other side, I was able to set aside the default. Is that not the process they use in the Second Judicial District? Or?
Well, they file a motion to lift the default. And in that motion, they made certain allegations about how the resident agent failed to forward documents to the company. Department 4 bent over backwards for them to give them the opportunities to bring evidence to support their allegations. They didn't bring any. We find out for the first time at the hearing that the counsel retained by the insurance company has never even had contact with the insurer. They were told to bring affidavits. They were told to bring witnesses. They were told to bring something to support the allegations. There was nothing to support the allegations but the bare argument of counsel.
How about the findings? You know, counsel's argument, the findings of the district court were not sufficient regarding damages and all that. What's your position on that?
I vehemently disagree, Your Honor.
Okay. Obviously, tell us why.
Under the Rader and Lawn case, it has to be allocated to that particular party. And that's exactly what the district court did here. The damages that were allocated, and it's in our moving papers, but it amounts to a combined 55.21% of all of the damages. That's how it was allocated. As a matter of fact, in the order setting forth the good faith settlement that was issued, and I believe it was May of 2013, it actually lays out what everybody paid. I mean, these were not amounts that were hidden.
As to that issue, I guess we go back to the building of it in terms of they've alleged that the documents that were provided to the court as the agreements were incomplete.
You're speaking about the contract, Sharon?
The basic contract.
Yes, it's a form contract that was used by Silver Star. So we have two different, called copies of the contract. The first copy is a full, complete contract that was for one of the Energetic entities, and the other one does have the bottoms of the pages cut off when it was copied. That is absolutely correct. But the key sections, specifically section 11.1A, which is the indemnity provision, and provision 27, which is the attorney's fees provision, They're as close to pristine as you can get because they're not there. Yeah, I agree. The bottoms of the pages that show the initials are cut off. But the signature page on the back is there, and it shows the signature.
Additionally, as the damages, it's been alleged that the damage weren't really specific to the two defendants. They were general damages, so to speak, as indemnification. Is that correct, or was it shown that they did X amount of fault was in fact their fault?
At the hearing, it was shown that these were the damages that were done, and these were the amounts. We had two expert witnesses, Ms. Hoy and Mr. Viviano, who came in and testified at length regarding those. There was a spreadsheet as an exhibit that's before you. It shows
damages overall, but specifically to these two named parties.
Yes, it was shown as specifically to these two named parties, and it was at, even more specifically, the damages for energetic left and plaster were identified, and the ones done by energetic painting and drywall were identified. And another issue that was raised in the moving papers that wasn't discussed had to do with the attorney's fees allocation. And again, that was allocated straight at the percentages.
She specifically asked the cost.
Right.
It was $1,500 limit.
Right. And that's actually set forth in the judgment. The district court specifically says, I recognize that these are there, these were helpful to the court, therefore the court authorizes these amounts in excess of the $1,500 that's there. But there's another issue here that we have raised in our moving papers as to whether or not this appeal can even be moving forward, where you have counsel who've never had any contact with their clients, and the client cannot agree. I mean, under NRAP Rule 3A, it's the aggrieved party is the party who must bring the appeal. The aggrieved party is energetic. It's not the insurance company. If without energetic's agreement, the entire appeal was moved from day one. And, you know, we're here on a very serious matter. But
I would imagine the insurance policy between energetic and their insurance company allows the insurance company to come in and participate in the defense of any litigation filed against them. So usually, don't you like to get the insurance companies involved, because that means you can get some money versus a defunct entity?
We tried to get the insurance companies involved on two separate occasions before we even got to the point where the default motion had to be left. Silver Star, originally, because we have this case via an assignment from Silver Star, in July of 2012 contacted the adjuster. There were a number of cases that were related. They contacted the adjuster and said, we want you to be involved. And the insurance company declined, which was followed up approximately a month later by a declination letter. Again, fast forward, once the mandatory settlement conference had been set forth, Silver Star again contacts them and says, hey, we understand your issues, but we still want you to be participating in this so we can try and get things resolved. They still didn't come to the mandatory settlement conference. And we have a judicial finding on that fact. They had other adjusters who were there, but in this case, I mean, there's a judicial finding that energetic lath and plaster and energetic painting and drywall never appeared at the mandatory settlement conference.
Through any type of representative?
Through any type of representative, counsel or via a claim adjuster.
Okay, so you're saying they had plenty of notice, you tried to get them involved for months, and they just didn't, and came in at the very last minute and did this, participated in the case.
Asking them to get involved for months, I think, is a slight overstatement. There were two separate things that happened approximately 9 months apart. But yes, on multiple occasions, they attempted to get them to appear to try and resolve issues, and they didn't.
What's the result if we find in your favor about that? I think you're raising standing issues that you're raising here.
That's right, and if that's the case, then the judgment stands. If the appeal is improperly before this court, then there's no appeal.
But they did make a general appearance on behalf of the energetic entities, so.
Yeah. They did make a general appearance, and at that hearing for the very first time is when we learned of the fact that they had never even had any contact with anybody, and they never even tried. Then after they filed the appeal in this case, We filed a motion for a supersedis bond. Ultimately, that was denied by the district court. But in opposition to that, the captive counsel, not the counsel who's here, but the counsel who are employees of the insurance company, they invited for us to execute on the assets of Energetic Lap and Plaster and Energetic Painting and Drywall, which creates a clear conflict. As a matter of fact, Lexington then, about 2 months later, sought to intervene, claiming that there was an unwaivable conflict between the captive counsel who had been acting on behalf of Energetic and Energetic at that point in time.
Did Energetic have a bond with the State Contractors Board?
I believe that they did. I also believe that bond had been withdrawn, revoked prior to the entry of judgment.
Okay. Anything further?
Thank you. If you have any further questions.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tyson.
Thank you.
Your rebuttal?
If you could address the counsel's position at not your firm, but the insurance company was dilatory in getting involved in this case and participating long after the default was entered.
That's exactly what I was going to discuss to you. Thank you. The issue with regard to the involvement of the insurance company, the insurance adjuster was aware of the proceedings, had spoken with Silver Star's counsel. That is undisputed. My understanding was it was a reservation of rights based on an issue, and the declination initially was due to an SIR issue. There was a $25,000 SIR that had not been satisfied. They were under the assumption that this was a single family home. There was no way a cost of repair to these two entities was going to exceed this SIR. So it wasn't a primary, and I don't want to speak for them at that time and go back in time, but that was sort of the mindset, if you will.
Wouldn't it have been prudent for them, knowing about the litigation, to file a declaratory relief lawsuit regarding the coverage issue and, you know, protect themselves? I mean, the insurance company, and they apparently decided later on to get involved in the case, so that they're kind of stuck with these delays that maybe it's their fault, though.
You know, in my opinion, if it was my practice, I agree it would have been prudent to do something more, but that doesn't change the fact that there hadn't been sufficient service of process to begin with. And with regard to their participation at that mandatory settlement conference, the issue there is while they were aware of it, they had already been defaulted. They technically had no legal ability to participate in that conference. I understand they'd been invited, but they couldn't actually have acted had they gone because of the fact that there was a default against them already.
But there's no judgment. So
there's no judgment.
I think counsel's right. I think the 6 months applies after the judgment's entered, but there's still an excusable neglect argument once the default's entered. I mean, you can't wait forever, you know, on the default.
I understand.
Can I ask you a question on the service? This is my concern on your argument. Counsel's saying that the only time you have to serve the officers is if it's a substituted service by mail or publication and all. If it's a personal service and the resident agent is still there, why should companies that are charters in default have more rights than a company that's not in default when you only have to serve the resident agent and that's sufficient service? So I explain the logic of that to me.
Well, the statute says what it says. The statute requires that when a corporation has been revoked, and it's any corporation, it's not just a foreign corporation, that the requirements for service of process are twofold. It's the service of process on the resident agent and mailing to the last known representatives of the entity. That's not an onerous burden. It's not a difficult thing to do. And it just wasn't done. Our position has always been that it's just not sufficient service, and that voids the default judgment. Therefore,
voiding the proceedings.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gidden. Ms. Tyson, thank you for your arguments in this matter and your brief submitted to us. The case will stand submitted.